Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back, everybody. It's time once again for this partnership between the Star Tribune editorial board and WCCO Radio. Chad Hartman here from WCCO. Patricia Lopez and John Rash from the Star Tribune. Patricia, let's circle back because the three of us have not chatted since a week ago.
No, when so much has happened.
Exactly. Since the New York Times, among other items, and because so much has happened, you're 100% right, had the anonymous op-ed from a senior administration official, highly critical of what is taking place within the White House, even though saying that on philosophy, they agree with a lot of the Trump administration's principles. Mm-hmm. Take me through how the editorial board at the Trib would have reacted to something like this and the line of having an anonymous op-ed.
It's a little hard to do that completely because we have not had those conversations.
Yeah.
As to, you know, finding ourselves in that situation. So I can't say for sure what we would in fact do. I can tell you, I've been surprised by the number of people who have contacted me saying, you know, they think that anonymous means it was anonymous to the New York Times. It certainly wasn't.
No.
I mean, there are people at the New York Times who know who this senior official is. However, the line between editorial and news, and there really truly is one, means that they are not going to communicate to the news department at all about who that individual is.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a little bit. You know.
So first of all, you would have to have a number of conversations among the editorial board, senior members. Certainly the publisher would have a say in this. They would have to come to some kind of consensus that this was the right thing to do. The people who knew, and I don't think it's the whole editorial board, it's probably no more than a couple of people who actually know the identity, would have to agree to keep it secret because that is, you know, they are bound by that no matter what. And then they just, you know, they have to take the heat that comes with that because there's going to be a lot of pressure, as you can see, including, all the denials that were issued by all of the top cabinet members.
John, what do you think?
That the denials themselves doesn't mean much to me or perhaps anyone. And everyone has pointed, and I think it's appropriate to reflect this, the example of Deep Throat, Mark Felt, who then was number two at the FBI, who denied that he was speaking to Bob Woodward. And it wasn't until he was close to his death that he revealed, you know, who he was.
So surprise! I think
for 40 years, he denied.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it certainly could be the case that the senior administration official maintains that kind of stance for the next 40 years. I think it's probably more likely that either the New York Times newsroom itself or another journalistic enterprise is able to crack the code and figure out who indeed wrote this. But Patricia's quite right. There is a strong line of separation between the newsroom and the editorial board. I found among the most striking dynamics of this is that if this person is truly intent on thwarting the president's worst impulses, as he or she described, you know, in the piece, it would seem that the ability to do that would be done much better, completed, you know, with more efficacy if they didn't write this op-ed. So, you know, I'm not sure to the degree that this was virtue signaling, you know, from someone who eventually realizes that, you know, they want to come out and say, I did everything I could, you know, to try to thwart the president's poor decision-making on this or that policy. But, you know, I think that right now President Trump is clearly much more on guard in terms of his aides, you know, trying to stop any bit of his agenda all the way down to he's probably watching his desk a lot closer after the revelation in Bob Woodward's new book, Fear, that reportedly Gary Cohn, who was head of the economic advisors at that point, slipped a piece of paper off his desk, which in effect would have announced the beginning of the process to cancel the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement, a really big policy issue. So I think that it'll be harder for this individual and the person he or she purports to speak for to accomplish that objective.
I don't think it was virtue signaling, though. I think it was actually part of the political strategy. I think they were signaling all right. They were signaling to important Republicans, to voters out there, to donors, that we've got this. It's not as crazy as it seems. We know you're worried about things going off the rails. We support the president's agenda. That agenda, by the way, is in part dependent on keeping control of Congress.
Yes.
So what's the paramount goal right now is to keep that control and not have, you know, a complete, tidal wave. So to the extent that that is going to give comfort, because there are Republicans out there, not a lot, but some, who have been saying, vote Democratic. If you just vote, you know, it's just been an isolated one. But Democrats mostly are saying, if you're tired of this, the only answer is to vote Democrat. So to the extent that this piece can allay those fears of Republicans who are, you know, maybe tired of the president's antics, but like the actual agenda, that's who this was speaking to.
So, John, let's get to one scenario, which I've seen debated a couple times. I want to get your thoughts and Patricia's thoughts on it. Let's say the editorial board looks at the, I forget the number we're at now, we're at 30, 40 officials in senior positions who have denied it. And the editorial board knows one of them is the person and knows they are lying. Do they do anything about that? Does that change this broker, this deal they had to keep this person anonymous if this person is denying it? Or isn't it just the same thing as Mark Felt and Bob Woodward?
The latter. It does not change anything. My assumption is that the senior executives with the editorial board, and as Patricia rightly mentioned, probably all the way to the publisher, the New York Times, have to realize that this person may indeed come out and deny being the author of this op-ed, and yet they've made an agreement that they're going to protect the anonymity of the individual. And again, as Patricia mentioned, of course they know who it is, but you know they're going to keep it anonymous. I think that there's no scenario in which they come forward and out the person. It'll be quite compelling if indeed it's the New York Times newsroom or another one who is able to come forward, you know, with who that person is. And then you're going to have a whole lot perhaps more said by, you know, the senior editors of the editorial board at that time. But no, I don't think they're going to in any way contradict.
Right. Yeah. This is why you have all those conversations, because you have to talk about all the different scenarios, all the pressure that's going to start building with all the denials that have been coming out. The pressure starts ratcheting up. And the board had to talk through all those scenarios. I'm sure none of this that has unfolded since then has surprised them.
Patricia, should the Times writers feel any different pressure in trying to track down who this is compared to their colleagues all across the country?
They do their job as they define it, completely apart from the decisions that the editorial board has made.
You know, I think that with all of these machinations, not just politically, but journalistically as well, it does suggest to me that this had to be a high-level individual. I think it would have been extraordinarily irresponsible if the New York Times would have run this if this is someone several rungs down the ladder.
They wouldn't do that.
And
so how high up? How high up does this person have to be? Because some have said it was a fairly nebulous term, senior administration official.
Well, that's by definition. You don't want to have, a term that winds up identifying or narrowing the pool such.
Yeah.
Let's say they had said a cabinet official.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, there are only so many of them. So they kept it purposely vague. My thought is it had to be someone who has seen some of these events unfold, is in contact with the president, is in contact with, you know, cabinet members, a very senior official.
John, does it have to be one person? That's another theory, that this is a combination of individuals. But if you label the person a senior administration official, does that end that idea?
I think it would have been more powerful if it was a combination of people who had come together. And I think accordingly, the New York Times would have labeled it as such, if that there were multiple people not only engaging in this kind of, you know, in-office behavior, but who came together to come to the New York Times editorial board. So my sense is, at minimum, the author of the piece is an individual.
You know, this is a fun parlor game, but really what kind of gets lost in this is the
The words
themselves, which are quite alarming.
Yes.
You are talking about an individual who says that there are other individuals acting in concert to thwart this president on things that they, as unelected, non-elected officials, not accountable to the public, have deemed are going too far. Well, you know, we have ways of dealing with that. And I find it not comforting at all that there are this little group of self-appointed individuals that have taken it upon themselves to basically act as the president.
Let's switch the topic here to something I know the editorial board has written about a number of times, but seemingly the public has decided to a certain level they don't care about, which I'm surprised by. It's the federal deficit. I read from a recent Washington Post story. The government spent $895 billion more than it brought in from taxes and other revenue sources during the past 11 months. This is a 33% hike from last year. Certainly, President Obama ended up taking a lot of heat on the increase. And if you look at percentage-wise, the percentage increase actually went up higher under George W. Bush than it did under Barack Obama. You look at where it was. Patricia, I'll start with you first. In 2010, the debt was at $12.8 trillion. It's now at $21.5 trillion. Mm-hmm. How has this moved off the political landscape?
Well, you know, you can thank the tax cut for this. You know, the fact is tax cuts are booked as spending. So when the government cuts taxes and doesn't increase revenue and, you know, doesn't cut spending, this is what happens. And it's going to keep on getting bigger as the tax cuts get, you know, fully phased in. It's astounding to me that even with this news that the debt has risen by a third, that they are still talking about another round two of the tax cuts. That should be, in my opinion, completely off the table until they start, carving down this deficit and laying out a plan for dealing with it.
Although, did Hillary Clinton bring up the deficit that much? Because I don't remember the Democrats touting this much either.
No, but they probably also wouldn't have passed that mega tax bill.
They wouldn't have, but it did. The debt did rise dramatically under Barack Obama.
Yes, it did. Well, he was also, I'm not here to apologize, you know, for him, but, you know, we were recovering from the Great Recession, which was just a hair short of a depression.
Yep.
You know, that was a tremendous blow to the economy, required intense, government spending and other fiscal measures to get things back on their feet, you know, saving other industries. We were still fighting wars at that point, you know, which gets very expensive and nobody wants to pay through those for tax increases. So it all winds up being borrowed money, essentially.
John, for the senatorial race, we have two Senate seats that are in play. I never hear it come up.
You know, there's been an incredible inversion in politics on so many levels in this country. But one of them is that for decades, the Republicans ran as strong on Russia and strong on deficits. And in many ways, it's now the Democrats who have tried to put more pressure on the relationship with Russia. And to the degree that it's brought up at all, and I concur with both of you that very little of it has been discussed in the Beltway, but it's generally Democrats who have focused on this in resistance to the tax cuts or with the idea of curbing military spending or some of the other dynamics here. I think from a broader perspective, the reason that this doesn't resonate with the public as much as it's framed inappropriately, it's looked at through existing taxpayers and especially those deeper into their career who have more economic wherewithal to pay significant taxes, and so a lot of the tax cuts are targeted to them and a lot of the discussion surrounds them, as opposed to framing this, what I think would be more appropriately, towards children and grandchildren, that this is a big bill that is being run up and it's on their tab that they're going to have to pay, and it's going to have a significant impact on the quality of life in America once it, you know, they have to reckon with this. And until the political narrative changes towards that, I don't think it's going to raise that dramatically in the public's eye, short of a significant fiscal emergency, which is always possible.
The alarming thing is that a number of Republicans, who, as John correctly says, used to be the party of fiscal restraint, and with a particular focus on the debt and the deficit, are now saying that deficits don't matter. You know, they've bought into this fairy tale that somehow if you cut taxes enough, the economy is going to grow magically and grow out of It's deficit. It hasn't happened before. It's not going to happen this time. We're already at full employment. There'll be some improvements, but the hard reality that I think both sides are going to have to acknowledge is that we spent ourselves into a mountain of debt, and we just gave away a ton of money, and we still have all of our existing obligations for Social Security, healthcare, education, the military, so on and so forth. There has to be a reality check at some point soon.
John, I know you want to jump in. Can I phrase it this way and then get to your point, too? I look at it in some ways, picking up on what Patricia just said. I think this is like, from a lot of politicians, I want to stay elected.
Mm-hmm.
I want to stay
right.
in this office. And a lot of these decisions are the really tough decisions, which a lot of my voters might not like. So why don't
they
just
certainly won't like.
Why don't I just keep pushing this off? Because guess what? I get to remain senator. I get to remain mm-hmm. congressman.
Mm-hmm. Eat your spinach is not a good bumper sticker.
Yeah.
You know? So
right.
And that's basically what you have to say. And the problem clearly could become worse. You mentioned Secretary Clinton in her run for the presidency. Well, part of it was she was pressured from the left by the insurgent candidacy of Bernie Sanders. And if you look at what's happening in the Democratic Party right now,
yeah.
the big story are decades-long incumbents being beaten by candidates who are advocating for universal health care and many other programs that
bigger
are
government.
Quite popular, absolutely, with the base, but clearly will be more expensive and will only exacerbate the deficit.
I would challenge that. I don't think it's been proven that extending health care is necessarily going to cost more. If we moved away from an employer-based system, that would probably do more to free up business than any other single thing we could do to make them more competitive. Businesses in other parts of the country do not bear this burden of having to carry insurance for their employees. It's a huge drag on them, seldom gets talked about. There's also the issue of, people with limited or no health care often wind up with the most expensive health care, which is emergency rooms and, delayed illnesses that wind up compounding and, becoming life-threatening. A system where everybody had insurance and could, deal more in preventive care, I think might very well wind up being not that much more expensive than what we have now. It would just be different.
It would be different.
Right.
It might be different for all of us, but What wouldn't be different is the size of government debt, right?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that would grow significantly. Maybe the money the three of us spend in a different way, potentially, if you accept some of the ideas a lot of people believe, would be better. But it's going to dramatically grow
right.
the size
but
of government.
Let's not, the problem with talking about the debt is that it often becomes complicated because, people keep piling brick after brick. Well, it's this. Well, it's that. Well, it's everything. Well, and then you throw up your hands. You can't do anything. You have a really good cause and effect right here. Cut taxes, 33% increase in the debt. There's your cause and effect right there. So, how about we not try to do everything and let's just do the one thing? Let's first at least not cut more taxes that could escalate it even further. And then let's think about whether some of those tax cuts, which, by the way, mostly went to upper income and corporations, we know that now, whether that needs to be retooled in some way.
We're going to pause right there. Good information as always. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Patricia Lopez and John Rash from the Star Tribune. Chad Hartman here from WCCO. Thank you so much for listening as always.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.